Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. As Russian and Ukrainian negotiators prepared on Wednesday to discuss ways to release millions of tons of cereals from Ukraine's Black Sea ports, a top UN agency chief appealed to countries that export key foodstuffs around the world not to make them more expensive than necessary. Qu Dongyu, who's head of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, told the agency's Committee on Commodity Problems that it was essential that countries stop using trade measures that add to price increases and extreme price volatility. Any protectionist tactics that exporting countries put in place will only harm those that depend on global markets for their food security, the FAO Director General warned. According to FAO, the global food import bill is on course to hit a new record high of $1.8 trillion this year. This is because of higher prices and transport costs, rather than volumes. Despite the fact that most trade happens within regions, multilateral trade remains the most efficient way to promote market access and economic growth for all, Mr. Qu insisted. He said that trade played a key role in ensuring global food security and sustainability, since it promotes food security and nutrition by linking food surplus regions with those in deficit. Mr. Qu also highlighted how FAO's proposed food import financing facility would help to provide financial support for the countries worst hit by the global food and energy crisis. In Sri Lanka, a peaceful political transition must take place, the UN Human Rights Office said on Wednesday. The appeal on Twitter from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, followed days of protests that have seen government buildings overrun and President Gotabaya Rajapaksa reportedly flee the country. Before the latest dramatic scenes in Colombo, the UN Human Rights Office urged the Sri Lankan authorities to show restraint with demonstrators after reports of the use of tear gas, water cannon and live ammunition against them. Widespread economic misery is credited with sparking the latest widespread protests, as people have been forced to queue for hours at petrol stations to buy fuel, while other basic needs such as food, health and education go unmet. Top UN-appointed independent rights experts have condemned Russia's continued and heightened crackdown on civil society groups, human rights defenders and media outlets. In an appeal to Moscow to stop what they characterized as a clampdown on civic space, the rights experts insisted that the situation had worsened dramatically since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Most independent Russian media outlets have closed down to avoid prosecution or have been blocked, along with dozens of foreign media, the rights experts continued. They also noted that over 20 media outlets stopped operating or suspended their work in the country, including the Nobel Peace Prize-winning newspaper Novaya Gazeta, the last independent TV channel, Dozhd, and the radio station Echo of Moscow. Twitter, Facebook and Instagram are also blocked in Russia today, according to the rights experts, who said that Meta had been designated an extremist organization and banned. Of the many thousands of Russians who protested peacefully against the war, over 16,000 of them, including many human rights defenders, have been detained for participating in or covering peaceful anti-war protests, the experts said in a statement. Excessive force was used against protesters and human rights defenders who had been detained, the experts alleged, along with humiliating and threatening tactics. And those providing legal assistance to the detainees have allegedly also been denied access to police stations and courts by law enforcement officials, they said. To global health now, and in addition to tackling COVID and the monkeypox outbreak, the UN Health Agency has also been keeping a close eye on the puzzling spread of hepatitis in children, which has left dozens needing life-saving liver transplants. According to a new update from the World Health Organization, WHO, 35 countries in 5 regions of the world have reported more than 1,010 probable cases of unexplained severe acute hepatitis in youngsters since the outbreak was first detected on the 5th of April. So far, 22 children have died, and almost half the probable cases have been reported in Europe, where 21 countries have had 484 cases. This includes 272 cases, or 27% of the global total, in the UK, followed by the Americas, whose regional total of 435 includes 334 cases in the US, a third of global cases. The next highest caseload is in the Western Pacific, with 70 cases, Southeast Asia, 19 cases, and Eastern Mediterranean, with 2 cases. 17 countries have reported more than 5 probable cases, but the actual number may be underestimated, in part owing to the limited enhanced surveillance systems in place, said WHO, which said that the current risk of the hepatitis outbreak spreading is moderate. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Andrew Seidel about the Supreme Court's devastation of the wall between church and state. Andrew is the author of the new book coming out in September called American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. We will also speak with attorney John Filo, executive director of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. The Sugar Law Center is handling many cases that support the rights of working people and people of color who are fighting back against corporate power. Joining me to interview John today is guest co-host Julie Hurwitz, who was the founding director of the Sugar Law Center. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. At issue was school employees' First Amendment rights to religious expression while on the job. The court held that a school district infringed on football coach Joseph Kennedy's First Amendment rights when it disciplined him for engaging in, quote, private, unquote, prayer. Kennedy was a coach at the Bremerton School District in Washington State. After games, he knelt on the field with some students joining him in prayer. That so-called private prayer occurred on the 50-yard line. The school district forbade the coach to pray on the field after games. It did allow him to pray in a private location behind closed doors. After Coach Kennedy continued on the field to give his thanks to God, the school district placed him on administrative leave. It gave him a poor evaluation despite a history of positive ones. Kennedy did not return the following year, and he sued, seeking reinstatement. He also relocated to Florida. The Supreme Court upheld Kennedy's right to pray in public on the field after the game. Joining us to discuss the Supreme Court's decision in this case and the issue of Christian nationalism generally is Andrew Seidel. Andrew is a constitutional attorney and vice president of strategic communications at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, which litigated Kennedy versus Bremerton. He's also the author of several books, including The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, and American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom, which hits the shelves in September and explains a lot of what is happening at the court right now. Andrew, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Andrew, what was the Supreme Court's holding in Bremerton?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the court falsely described really coercive prayer as personal, and it blocked public schools from protecting their students' religious freedom. You know, the opinion and the whole thing, it was breathtakingly dishonest and lawless even. And it actually makes the opinion difficult to sort out because it was so dishonest. The conservative judges got the justices, got the law and the facts wrong. They bought into what a Republican nominated circuit court judge called a, quote, deceitful narrative. And then they used those alternative facts that we heard so much about under the Trump administration to attack a founding American principle, the separation of church and state. So, it really is a radical departure from the protections that school children have had for decades.
Andrew, does Bremerton reverse longstanding precedent and overrule the well-known case of Lemon versus Kurtzman? What is the Lemon test?
Oh, those are such good questions, and they're kind of scary, the answers, really. So Gorsuch didn't technically overruled the Lemon Test. At least he didn't use those words. What he said was that judges should know not to use the Lemon Test because it has been ignored and criticized for so long. So essentially he's saying Lemon is dead, but I actually think that that makes his opinion here really dangerous because it gives the green light to even more conservative judges and even more politically motivated judges on the Fifth and the 11th Circuits, for instance, to decide cases in line with their political whims and not worry about precedent at all. Because even if precedent still stands, as Lemon does and has, if they can point to any criticism or a time when that test or case or precedent wasn't applied, then they can say, what Gorsuch is saying here, that we should know not to apply that test. So I mean, I think we're seeing the full-on abandonment of stare decisis in favor of conservative politics here. Now, to answer your question, you know, what is the Lemon Test? This is something that the court synthesized back in 1971. So what the Supreme Court did was it looked back on all the cases that it had decided about the government using government power and resources to promote or advance or inculcate or impose one particular religion over others, or even religion generally over non-religion. And then after that survey, it formulated this simple three-part test about whether a government action crosses that constitutional line. And the test is basically this. Does the challenged government action, one, have a secular purpose? Two, have the principal or primary effect that neither advances nor inhibits religion? And three, foster excessive government entanglement with religion. And if the government action fails any one of those three prongs, then it failed the Lemon Test and had to be struck down. Now, almost as soon as the test was synthesized, it started being attacked. But that was not because there was anything wrong with the test. It was because 6 months later, the court actually looked a lot different. Two of the justices who crafted much of the precedent that Lemon was built on were gone. So Lewis Powell replaced Hugo Black, who was a strong supporter of state church separation. And meanwhile, you have Powell, who penned a memo that some believe served as the kind of master plan for the modern conservative movement. And then you have William Rehnquist replacing John Marshall Harlan II. And then later you obviously get Scalia. So, you know, over the years, these justices became a kind of core that nipped and stabbed and bit at the Lemon Test at every opportunity. But I really think it's important for everybody to understand that the Lemon Test it's a good test. Well, there was nothing wrong with it. It was that the makeup of the court began to change, and conservative justices who were hostile to the outcomes dictated by that test were appointed. So, you know, I mean, it was a strong precedent. It was an 8-1 decision that synthesized decades of rule-defining precedents. And it itself was strong precedent that was older than Roe versus Wade. The problem has always been the court has been unwilling to apply that legal principle for fear of popular backlash. And now it's either on a shelf or overturned, depending on which version you want to go with.
Can you please discuss the court's new history and tradition test?
Well, I have some thoughts on this test. first, let me say that for this case, it actually didn't matter for the Kennedy versus Bremerton case, because whatever test the court should have applied here, if it had applied them to the actual facts on the ground, this case would have failed the Lemon Test, the endorsement test, the coercion test, you know, any one of them. And the history and tradition test is not a real test. It is a way to evade the rule of law. Basically, the history and tradition test says this: if it was acceptable or right back then at the founding or the framing, then it's fine now. So, I mean, really, this is not a test. It's retrogressive politics masquerading as a legal test. And all we need to do is think about where we would be on things like segregation or interracial marriage if history and tradition were the test. And the second thing people need to understand is that judges are remarkably bad at history. So 2 years ago, I published a law review article called Bad History, Bad Opinions, which actually shows how judges and lawyers cherry pick and manipulate history to achieve litigation goals. And this is so common that it actually has a name. It's called law office history. And in the religious freedom and church state arena, law office history is just a plague. And that's what the article I wrote was about. It was specifically about prayer in the school context. So it was really on point for this case. And it is rampant in this context, which I document in the article. And it's also rampant at the Supreme Court right now. I mean, so the history and tradition test that we saw wasn't just in the Kennedy versus Bremerton case. We saw quite a few opinions, actually, in the last few weeks that venerate and glorify history and tradition over established legal principle and fact. So we had the Carson versus Macon case, in which the court forced taxpayers to fund religious indoctrination and education, the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin case, the Dobbs decision, which abolished reproductive freedom, and then the case that we've been talking about, Kennedy versus Bremerton. And in each of those, the justices glorified and venerated history and tradition because they are trying to drag us back to a time when white conservative Christian men ruled, when their rights were the only rights that mattered. And this is something that I talk about in my new book, American Crusade, how the Supreme Court is weaponizing religious freedom. I explain that the justice's overriding principle here is not reality or the law or the Constitution, but simply this: Christians win. And that is where we are right now.
And Andrew, that's the excuse that the Supreme Court, the right-wing majority of the Supreme Court, used to overrule the constitutional right to abortion, because abortion was not historically protected in the 19th century.
So they said.
As the excuse, right.
Yeah.
In Bremerton, the court found that when the coach prayed on the 50-yard line, he was not acting in the scope of his coaching duties. The majority said it would be an excessively broad job description to treat everything coaches and teachers do and say, quote, in the workplace, unquote, as government speech subject to government control. But don't students look up to coaches as authority figures and role models? Isn't the coach the king while on the football field?
Absolutely. And that is just one of the many problems with this opinion. Students felt pressured to pray with the coach because of the authority he wielded and abused. I mean, that is in the factual record. There were amicus briefs that documented the psychology of this authority, and professional athletes and coaches who explained the role that it played in their lives. And in a way, the coach himself even admitted this when he said he was trying to make these kids into, quote, better people, right? He is wielding his power as an agent of the state. He had access to these kids because of his role as a public school official. He had access to the field because he was acting in his official capacity. Everything about this was a coach acting as a coach with power over the players. I mean, to say that this was a private moment is really just absurd.
How did the coach's language confuse the issue? He said his prayers were personal and private. Did the dissent refute that characterization?
So this really goes back to the, quote, deceitful narrative that Judge Smith warned us about at the Ninth Circuit. And I would really encourage your listeners to go read. I'll read just a brief section of it, because it's remarkable to hear a federal judge write like this. So Judge Smith wrote, unlike Odysseus, who was able to resist the seductive song of the sirens being tied to a mast and having his shipmates stop their ears with beeswax, our colleague, Judge O'Scanlan, appears to have succumbed to the siren song of a deceitful narrative of this case spun by counsel for appellant to the effect that Joseph Kennedy, a Bremerton High School football coach, was disciplined for holding silent private prayers. That narrative is false. Now, I don't know about you, but if a judge wrote that about me and my candor to the tribunal, I would go hide in a hole. I would seriously question my life choices. And instead, First Liberty Institute appealed to the Supreme Court and doubled down on that narrative. That says something truly remarkable about this particular Supreme Court. And I think Justice Sotomayor's dissent here was really brilliant. She countered, the majority's mendacious wordsmithing with photographic evidence that disproved the entire basis of the majority opinion. You know, she included three pictures, and that simple rebuttal, I think, leaves the Kennedy opinion seriously vulnerable to being overturned in the future. So I have hope that we can eventually restore the law. The fact that this was an opinion based on alternative facts and so divorced from reality really ought to make it weak precedent moving ahead.
Andrew, in this case, Americans United argued that the case was moot because the coach had relocated to Florida. Americans United's principal briefs also addressed how some students are harmed when coaches instigate prayer. Please elaborate on that.
Yeah, this is kind of remarkable too, and it sort of goes to that deceitful narrative, I think, as well. The coach sold his house and moved to Florida in the middle of this case. And his lawyers didn't tell the court. And this was 2 years ago, before he even petitioned for cert at the Supreme Court. And worse, the coach was only asking to be reinstated. That was the only remedy he was seeking. He wasn't asking for damages or anything like that. So the relief he wanted wasn't really possible, right? He and his wife moved literally across the country and bought a new house, registered as Florida voters, and talked about how they were proud to be Floridians now. And yet, the court didn't punt on the case, even though this position that he is asking to be reinstated to is less than $5,000 a year. And it's only a couple months of work. And I truly believe that is because this court and these judges are eager to decide these cases. And that is, by the way, the subject of my next book, American Crusade. I believe they are on a crusade to help weaponize religious freedom.
2 years ago, you spoke with us about the Supreme Court ruling in the case Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn v. Governor Cuomo. That case reversed precedent. How did that case and others pave the way for the current Bremerton decision?
That's such a good question. And that case is also mentioned in the new book. And these are all part of the same crusade, the cases that are brought by the same conservative legal groups in the same shadow network that helped put some of these same judges on the bench. And what we have seen time and again is the conservative judges willing to rewrite facts and ignore precedent to vindicate the principle that I identified earlier, that Christians win. And you saw that in this Kennedy case, the coaching case, and you saw it in the diocese case out of New York. In both, this court is only looking at the religious freedom of conservative Christians and ignoring the religious freedom and health and safety in the case of the COVID cases of everybody else. But I mean, you particularly see it in the Kennedy case. The court focused exclusively on the coach and his religious freedom. And I mean, notably absent from that majority opinion was any mention of the students and the fact that their religious freedom was trampled by an agent of the state.
Andrew, the Supreme Court also decided a case from the state of Maine this term that eroded the wall between church and state. What happened in that case?
So Maine wanted to provide a public education to all kids in the state. Great. But in some districts, there actually weren't enough kids to support building a high school. Literally, the state was too rural to recommend constructing a building, a local high school. So instead, what it decided to do was give parents some money to send their kids to a public or a private school. And the program was meant to provide a non-sectarian public education. And because the state is taxing citizens and then turning around and giving that money for education, it puts safeguards in place to ensure that the religious freedom of the taxpayers and of the students wouldn't be violated. And that meant that the money had to be spent on a secular education, just like what they would have gotten at a public school. And after all, the point is to provide a public education. And actually, the program, as it was challenged, was actually set up, Breyer makes this clear in his opinion in the case, so that religious schools could even receive some of the program funding as long as the funds were used for a secular education, not a religious education. So the program was not discriminating against the character of the institution, which was the claim in the Espinoza and the Trinity Lutheran cases, but against the use of the funding. So really this wasn't discrimination, but a practical way to ensure a free public education. And it's important to note, a couple parents challenged this program, said you have to provide funds for us to send our kids to a Christian school too. And one of the Christian schools at issue was a place called Bangor Christian. Its educational objectives included having, quote, unsaved students to trust Christ as his or her personal savior and then to follow Christ as Lord of his or her life, end quote, and to, quote, develop within each student a Christian worldview and a Christian philosophy of life, end quote. Now, that's not education. That's indoctrination, and that's what Justice Sotomayor pointed out in her dissent. And that's exactly what the First Amendment is meant to prevent. But Chief Justice Roberts and the five other conservatives in a, I think, a remarkably poorly reasoned opinion, they gaslit the country. And they held that not funding religious education and indoctrination with public tax dollars was itself discrimination that violated the Free Exercise Clause. And I mean, it's just so remarkable to think about that, because non-discrimination is the basis for the court's opinion. The court says that it's preventing discrimination against Christians, and that's simply not true. Instead, the court is allowing Christians to discriminate and essentially forcing taxpayers to fund that. And again, the court is doing that, as we discussed earlier, by focusing only on the rights of Christians and ignoring everybody else's rights. In other words, discriminating, right? It's remarkable.
Andrew, what do you see in the future for the separation of church and state?
Yeah, that is the big question. And, you know, this court is clearly hostile to that founding principle. At Americans United, we believe that we need a national recommitment to the separation of church and state. For too long, Americans have taken the separation of church and state for granted. And I hate to say this, but we are about to get a real world lesson in what it is like to live in a country without that crucial protection. So really, this country does need that national recommitment. And AU is going to be leading the charge, just as it has for the last 75 years. So I really hope everybody listening joins us.
In your excellent book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, you unpack the relationship between religion and the U.S. government. What is the founding myth?
Thank you for that. The founding myth is has a special place in my heart, not only because it's my first book, but because it was burned by a pastor named Greg Locke in Tennessee, who was involved. He was in D.C. on January 5th preaching for the Proud Boys on stage and talking, you know, about going to war. He burned the book with a blowtorch. So if anybody needs a good reason to read it, I think that's probably the best review I've ever gotten. The founding myth is the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation and that we were built on Judeo-Christian principles. And this disinformation has been deliberately pushed by Christian nationalists. And we're actually seeing it a lot these days. Just this week, Charlie Kirk, that right-wing activist, was talking about it. Last week, Lauren Boebert preached it at a church in Colorado. We found out that a Florida curriculum change has led to trainings, which have essentially pushed this disinformation onto teachers in Florida, and Americans United has launched an investigation of those trainings and of that curriculum. So really, the founding myth is this central tenet of Christian nationalism, that we were founded as a Christian nation, that we were based on Judeo-Christian principles, and most importantly, in their eyes, that we've strayed from that foundation, right? That we've gotten away from those godly roots. And they use that language of return and getting back to those godly roots to justify all manner of hateful and evil public policy. And as we're seeing and as we've been talking about, even Supreme Court decisions, right? Because it's that same historical history and tradition and the disinformation built into there is a common thread that runs between Christian nationalism and these decisions. And I do get into quite a bit of that in The Founding Myth and also in the new book, American Crusade.
How big a problem is Christian nationalism today?
Christian nationalism is an existential threat to the American Republic. It really is. I was very proud to organize and contribute to a report that laid out the connections between January 6th and Christian nationalism, and I worked on that with my friends at the Baptist Joint Committee, Amanda Tyler, and then talented academics and journalists like Jamar Tisby and Catherine Stewart, Andrew Whitehead, Sam Perry, and Anthea Butler. And what we showed in the report is that Christian nationalism really created the permission structure that gave the January 6th insurrectionists the moral and mental license that they needed to attack our government and attempt to overturn a free and fair election. I mean, they told us loudly, repeatedly, why they were doing this, what they believed, and why they believed it justified the attack. They told us about their Christian nationalism, and we really ought to listen to them, because if we don't, we're going to see a repeat.
Andrew, in our remaining minutes, please tell us about Americans United for Separation of Church and State and how our listeners can follow your work.
Americans United for Separation of Church and State is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit, educational and advocacy organization that it really works to bring together people of all religions and of no religion to protect the right of everyone to believe as they want and to stop anyone from using their beliefs to harm others. So we fight in the courts, in legislatures, and in the public square for freedom without favor and equality without exception. And AU has been on the front lines of this fight for 75 years. It has been the preeminent organization working to ensure that church-state separation remains that shield that protects the religious freedom for all of us. And I truly believe that we can only do that as Americans United. And that is why I'm so proud to be a part of an organization that embodies that value in its very name. And I really hope that everybody listening will join us at AU.org.
Andrew, thanks so much for your critical work and for joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Maurice Sugar was a worker's lawyer and a socialist, one of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, the first general counsel to the United Auto Workers, and a staunch defender of working people's rights. He was also a talented poet and songwriter of political songs and poems. In the 1950s, during the height of the Cold War, Walter Reuther was elected president of the UAW. His first official action was to fire Sugar. Maurice and his wife Jane Sugar, who was an activist and union organizer of teachers, homesteaded over 100 acres of property in the Black Lake area of Michigan. At their deaths, he in the 1970s and she in the 1980s, a trust was created which formed the financial seed money for the founding of the Maurice and Jane Sugar Law Center for Economic and Social Justice in Detroit, Michigan. In 1990, shortly after the death of Jane Sugar, a group of National Lawyers Guild national leaders, including NLG founding member Ernie Goodman, former national president Bill Goodman, both trustees of the M&J Trust, and former National President Deborah Evanson, used the endowment from the Sugar Trust to establish the Sugar Law Center. it brought to life a long-standing vision of creating a national public interest project of the NLG that would tackle the critical questions of the intersection between civil rights and economic justice. The Sugar Law Center began with a primary focus on plant closings and worker dislocation, and Julie Hurwitz was the founding director. Now, 32 years later, as a nationally recognized public interest workers' law project, the work of the Sugar Law Center has expanded to take on issues of runaway corporate power, racism, community dislocation, gentrification, poverty, environmental justice, women's rights, and many others. We have the honor and pleasure to speak today with the current executive director of the Sugar Law Center, John Filo, to discuss the critical work of the Sugar Law Center in fighting back against the rise of white supremacy, corporate power, and fascism. John has litigated cases in dozens of states representing low-wage workers, communities, and injured persons on matters of employment, constitutional, and tort law. John is also a former president of the Detroit chapter of the National Lawyers Guild and a contributing author to the National Lawyers Guild's Employee and Union Member Guide to Labor Law and the Institute of Continuing Legal Education's Torts, Michigan Law and Practice. We are also fortunate today to have with us attorney Julie Hurwitz as a guest co-host. John Filo, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's really an honor and a privilege to be on this show. You know, I follow closely, and it's a great service to folks out there.
John, we're thrilled to have you. We currently find ourselves in the midst of a constitutional and political crisis in the United States, with the growing strength of a right-wing, white supremacist movement that is bringing us closer to a fascist oligarchy. We have a radical right-wing Supreme Court that we can see from the past few weeks will not hesitate to put its stamp of approval on the direction our country is moving in. The expansion of corporate power, the protection of the wealthy ruling class. This court has not hesitated to overturn longstanding precedent that had recognized the constitutional right to abortion. It has trashed the wall between church and state, prevented the EPA from regulating against climate change, and proclaimed that the Second Amendment creates a fundamental right to buy, own, and openly carry firearms, including assault weapons. With that in mind, John, let us move to the specific work of the Sugar Law Center and discuss how your work fits into the larger progressive struggles to fight back against these assaults on our rights that are currently taking place. We'd like to talk with you today about two of the cases that the Sugar Law Center has taken on and how the work of the Law Center, both in and out of the courts, is critical to the fight against the current state of affairs in our country. First, I want to ask you about the case State Fair Coalition versus the City of Detroit. Please explain to our audience what this case is about.
Well, thank you for asking about that. This is an important case that really comes from the ground up. It comes from a grassroots coalition that brought us into the case to support their efforts in relation to Amazon. You know, at its most basic, the case is about the city government's sale of land to Amazon to develop a large parcel of land as a mega warehouse, and whether that sale followed the requirements of the city's community benefits ordinance. This ordinance is very unique. It's the first one in the country of its kind. Detroit residents put this on the ballot through a referendum over intense opposition from the mayor and from certain members of the city council. But they put it on the ballot without any large financial backing from any groups. They actually got passed in the city of Detroit a community benefits ordinance. What's a community benefits ordinance? It's an ordinance that says when these economic development projects happen, the developers have to sit down across from the table with local residents and come up with a plan where that project will address the residents' concerns. Too often we see economic development is simply a method to extract wealth from low-income communities. It is not about bringing that community any genuine benefits. The ordinance is to try and change that dynamic, to bring democracy to the process where those who are developing in that community have to sit down and be accountable to those community members.
John, what is the State Fair Coalition?
It's a coalition of community members, largely property owners or tenants, that surround what here was called the State Fairgrounds. It is low-income communities, a working-class community on three sides of it, and then one side is higher-income residents. They have joined together and working together in a genuine coalition that is multicultural, it is multiracial, it is multi-ethnic in every sense. And they came together to say, hey, this large parcel of land that's right situated in the middle of us, when the city develops it, it should be for the benefit of all of us. It shouldn't be just for the benefit of either the developers or the wealthiest neighborhoods that are adjacent to that property.
John, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Michigan State Fairgrounds in the city of Detroit?
Sure. The State Fairgrounds, it's a large parcel of land that's now empty in the city of Detroit. What it was the fairgrounds for the state of Michigan. At that time, it was used all the way up from 1904 to 2009 as the location of the Michigan State Fair. We had in our state one of the oldest state fair in the nation. And it really has a fascinating and interesting history. Some sense the state fair was placed where it is to give industrial workers the opportunity to experience and see some of the agricultural activities in the state. That was part of their background. Folks moved up here to work into industry, often from rural communities. Also transitioned over time to give inner city folks a real opportunity to see agriculture, something that was part of their histories, but they have been isolated from due to various racial policies, both in the South and in the North, that took black communities away from agricultural economics. But in any event, the State Fair in 2009, after a probably decade or two decades long starvation of state government, which was occurring in Lansing, our state capital, was the defunding of programs throughout state government, led to the state ending subsidies for the state fair. That caused a crisis in the economics, and the state actually shut down the state fair for a number of years. So when that happened, then there was a question arose what to do with this property. And this property is the largest sort of contiguous property that the city owns. And what the city has done is sold it below market value to one of the richest corporations in our country.
How did Amazon manage to obtain ownership and control over this vast piece of historic property in the city of Detroit?
Well, I think it's a prime example of disaster capitalism. They took advantage of the downturn in economics caused by the pandemic, but also the historical issues in Detroit and Detroit's government's perception that it needs economic development at any cost. Amazon plays the game quite well of playing one community off of each other to get the most benefits, the most tax breaks, the lowest amount of development costs, and that includes the largest amount of land that it can acquire at the lowest cost. What that all amounts to is whatever city is hosting Amazon's warehouse, they're significantly subsidizing it. And in this case, that subsidy took the form not only of tax breaks, but also of a below-market land transfer. The market, or the price for the land, was set by the city at substantially lower than what its value would have been if it was put out there in a bid process. That's typical of an Amazon development, and that shameless, quite frankly, given the wealth of that company to come to a community such as Detroit that needs taxes paid, that needs those jobs, but also needs fair market value for its assets. But Amazon was able to negotiate that deal with government officials over the threat of taking the development elsewhere.
So can you talk a little bit more, John, about some of these overarching issues that you've touched on with respect to the power that corporations like Amazon wield, and how this case that the Sugar Law Center is litigating impacts these larger issues of corporate expansion, movements for community benefits, racism, gentrification, and dislocation?
Sure. I think this case is really puts a real light on the contradictions we see in our economic structure right now, and the inherent racism, the inherent undermining of democracy that we see with the corporate expansion of corporate power that we've seen over the past decades into what we've come to today. I've already mentioned, I think you can see right off, it is a prime example of that sort of shock doctrine, that disaster capitalism, where a corporate entity is taking advantage on steroids of the issues that may exist in a particular community. For us, it also has very much a real focal on the transfer of public wealth to private hands. Well, where do you see that transfer? You see it in communities of color. You see it in low-income communities where there's a predatory environment that private industry seeks to extract wealth from those communities. What is the wealth of those communities? Things like public assets, things like a state fairground, public parks, but also waterworks, a host of other things. And we've seen that accelerate here in Detroit ever since its bankruptcy, which is a massive transference of wealth. It's the same with transferring the tax issues. The tax breaks that are given just to attract this sort of development without any promise that there's going to be real tangible benefits to the people who pay those taxes, it's just unconscionable. And this is an example of that. It also ties into basic democratic principles. This community benefits ordinance that we sued under for the city's failure to comply with, that was a grassroots effort put on the ballot by citizens and passed by citizens pursuant to their city charter. And the city's in tandem with the developer just ignoring that entirely, but more than ignoring it, treating it as if citizens' rules or the rules that apply to citizens don't apply to them. It's something that I think residents should find offensive and nothing less than that. We've actually had in the city now, which this is part of the confronting this sort of idea, we're not only granting tax breaks, we're starting to allow the corporations doing these sort of developments to actually directly capture the taxes of residents. That cannot stand. We very much see our role is pushing back against that in every way we can.
Well, good for you, John, and for the Sugar Law Center. We're speaking today with attorney John Filo, executive director of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. John, how does this case relate to the larger movements for progressive, social, and economic transformation in this country?
We do look at it as intimately related to democratic rights of citizens. The laws that are set on behalf of citizens, and it is their laws. And it is their law, particularly and most directly in this case, that we're seeking to enforce, one that was adopted by a popular vote. But then also the confrontation of the idea of economic development as a wealth extraction tool for developers, the wealthiest among us. We need to fight back against that every opportunity we can, and we need to develop models that force the developers enforce government officials who are working in tandem with them to be accountable directly to citizens. That's where we see this case tying in.
Thanks so much, John, for your discussion about this case. Now, there's another case that the Sugar Law Center is currently involved in. It's the case of Delgado versus ServPro. Could you tell us a little bit about this case and its impact in relationship to these issues on workers' rights, immigrant rights, and the fight against racism?
Okay, certainly. This is another case. You know, we're always asked at Sugar Law Center what we do, and a lot of our work translates directly to workplace safety issues, but we really look at the economic issues broadly. But I think Delgado particularly captures the workplace issues that we see and how that translates over into, you know, fundamental civil rights in a lot of ways. What this case is about is immigrant workers who were brought to Michigan to clean up after historic floodings, probably the largest natural disaster this state had ever seen, when two dams broke back in May 2020. Now, that was the time when the pandemic was, we were 3 months into the pandemic. These groups of workers were brought up, immigrant workers, and given no protections, no meaningful protections at all for pandemic. They were treated as disposable. They were all treated as independent contractors, which is just unconscionable. They all work for this company, which is ServPro, and its franchisor. They work for them, you know, throughout the year. They came. They were put up in hotels. They were given no instructions, no protocols for protection against the spread of the pandemic. Morning meetings were held on the work site in the morgue of one of the large hospitals that had suffered massive flooding. That morgue had held pandemic victims prior to the flooding, and these workers were brought in to help just clean all this stuff out. But they would hold morning meetings in these large open rooms with, you know, hundreds of workers just packed in without masks and without protections. So we got involved in that through a group called Resilience Force, which is doing a fantastic job and a very inspiring job of organizing, working to organize the workers who are involved in this disaster recovery. They're highly exploited because they're a fractured workforce, and they're often working for 3 months on intensively for 12 to or more hours every day, and then they're off for 2 months, and they go back to their home states. So the opportunities to organize are difficult to achieve, but Resilience Force is really committed to helping these workers advocate on their own behalf through workplace organizing.
John, what are the significant issues in this case that relate to the power of large corporations such as ServPro?
The larger issues we see, right? We're seeing in this, we call it a new economy. I'm not too sure how new it is, right? What we're seeing is new forms of exploitation at all times, right? If you listen to, let's say, the business radio, you will hear constant talk of new forms of work, new ways of working, and it's often portrayed as something that is wonderful, flexible, and implies that it's at workers' choice. For what we see, for the folks that we represent, what we're seeing is new forms of work that are highly exploitive, and they're dictated from above. That's the situation with these folks who do this work. They are classified as independent contractors, which means overtime is optional, depending on which company they're working for at any given time, whether that will be paid. There's no workers' compensation benefits. There's no unemployment insurance, and a host of other basic protections of your workplace don't apply. What that flexibility is for is not for any of these workers. It's to exploit those workers, as is their immigration status. They're looking for a workforce that they can exploit without accountability, without pushback. And it's the role of us, it's the role that, you know, I know resilience sports fields, for us to help give those workers voice, to get them the opportunity for them to stand up and organize.
So, John, tell us, what is the role of the Sugar Law Center with its work on these very important cases and all the other work that you're doing in relation to the escalating assault on people's rights in both the legal and political arenas that are coming from Washington, coming from many of the states, and coming from the courts?
You know, our foundational principle is that economic and social rights are civil rights and human rights. And there, we cannot realize our civil and political rights without those corresponding economic and social rights. So we look at ourselves as part of and providing support to every movement that is in opposition to the rights of people. And so within that, you will see our work has been, we have worked to support Black Lives Matter. Though we do not do direct civil and political rights, every one of these movements that we're going to see developing in opposition to what is happening in our country, we will be a part of it. And just to give you a few examples, as Black Lives Matter, we represented workers who were organizing in their workplace around Black Lives Matter's issues. For folks who wore buttons and were punished by their employer, for immigrants who participated in the Day Without Immigrants protest back when Trump was in power, but also with the abortion rights protests. We are working with Amicus. We are organizing with law professors to provide support to the work that Planned Parenthood and that hundreds of community organizations are doing throughout the country. We're doing the same thing along the threats to our democracy and those type of issues. We very much look at it as we need to be there to support the movements that are happening and that will continue to develop in opposition to what we are seeing as a historic repression of rights coming from Washington.
John, how can our listeners follow your important work?
There's a couple ways. One, directly through our website. Two, through our Facebook page is probably what gives you the most current events. But at our website and Facebook, you can sign up for our mailing list, and we will add you to that. And if there are folks who wish to volunteer time, who have legal skills or who have investigative skills or media skills, reach out to us. Send us an email, and we can find ways to connect and to work with folks and both in mutually beneficial ways.
What is that website, John?
It's www.sugarlaw.org. And then our email is mail@sugarlaw.org.
Well, thank you so much, John Filo, for joining us and telling us about these cases that Sugar Law is taking on to support people's struggles.
Thank you very much for having me. The work of both you, Marjorie and Julie, inspires me as well.
One, two, three, four! Woo.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I got to have it grooving. When I leave the piano, they kind of lose it. Dun-la-la, dun-dun-da-dun-la-la. Just follow me. Dun-la-la, dun-dun-da-dun-la-la. Here's letter A. Woo! Rocket, moonshot. Spend it all to have none. That's better. Money, we make it. Before we see it, you take it. Oh, better holler, wait until my life.
And coming up tomorrow on Free Thought Friday, Radio Free Kansas.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
That's tomorrow at noon on Free Thought Radio.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
From Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. If you want to, you local listeners in Kansas should know that Democracy Now! Airs 7 a.m. Central Standard Time here in Kansas, in Northeast Kansas, at 7 a.m. It's the full broadcast on PBS, the PBS affiliate of Kansas City, Missouri. Over the air, 19.2 over the air, and you can catch it at 7 a.m., which there's a lot more to the show than the headlines. Also, at 8 a.m., same day, every morning, 8 a.m., on KKFI FM radio, 90.1 KKFI radio has it at 8 a.m. every morning. So here we go. The headlines from Democracy Now! Today.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden arrived in Israel Wednesday for a four-day Middle East visit that includes a stop in Saudi Arabia. Israel's interim Prime Minister Yair Lapid held a red carpet ceremony as Biden landed at Ben-Gurion Airport, giving him what the New York Times called a rapturous welcome and calling him our brother Joseph. Before departing the airport, Biden toured a U.S.-funded advanced missile defense system. On Friday, Biden will visit the occupied West Bank and meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Ahead of Biden's trip, Biden activists hung banners in Bethlehem that read, "Mr. President, this is apartheid." Earlier today, Biden met with Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid in Jerusalem, where the pair discussed Iran's nuclear program and the war in Ukraine. The U.S. and Israel are expected to announce a joint declaration building on past calls to take military action to halt Iran's nuclear program. Biden's promised he won't agree to any deal that would restore the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, which the United States unilaterally withdrew from in 2018, if it means removing Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps from a list of foreign terrorist organizations. President Biden was asked about that pledge in a recorded interview with Israeli TV that aired Wednesday.
Are you committed to keep the IRGC on the foreign terrorist organization list, even if that means that kills the deal?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You, in the past, said you'll do anything, and you say it again, that you'll ensure Iran would not acquire nuclear weapons. Does that also mean, sir, that you would use force against Iran? Is that what that means?
That was the last resort, yes.
This weekend, President Biden will become the first U.S. president to visit Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, where he is scheduled to meet top Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. After headlines, we'll have more on President Biden's trip to Israel, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Saudi Arabia. The House of Representatives is set to vote this week on a record-shattering $839 billion military budget. The 2023 National Defense Authorization Act contains $37 billion more than President Biden requested, which in turn surpassed former President Trump's record military budget requests. Progressive Democrats Mark Pocan and Barbara Lee have proposed an amendment that would slash $100 billion from the military budget. Congressmember Lee said, quote, more guns and tanks are of no use to Americans without housing, education, or health care, she said. In Sri Lanka, one person was killed, scores of others injured after police used tear gas and water cannons to attack anti-government protests in the capital, Colombo. This comes after President Gotabaya Rajapaksa fled the country for the Maldives Wednesday, where he was met with protests. He's reportedly since left the Maldives aboard a Saudi airplane bound for Singapore, though it's not clear whether this is his final destination. Rajapaksa promised to resign by Wednesday, but has not yet done so. Ukrainian officials say at least 12 people were killed and more than two dozen injured after Russian missiles fell on an office building and homes in the central city of Vinnytsia. In southern Ukraine, Russian shells blasted a hole in a high-rise hotel in the city of Mykolaiv, where five people were reportedly killed by Russian shelling. In eastern Ukraine's Donetsk province, a Russian strike destroyed a school in the city of Kostyantynivka, leaving behind a massive crater. No one was injured in the attack, but students were left traumatized by the loss of their school.
Let this war end soon, and let everything be like it was before. Like before, when we all played together. Now they shell us. It is difficult to believe what's happening.
On Wednesday, negotiators from Russia and Ukraine held their first direct talk since March in Istanbul, Turkey, where they're reportedly nearing a deal that would allow Ukraine to export more than 20 million tons of grain from the Black Sea port city of Odessa. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the breakthrough a, quote, ray of hope to ease human suffering and alleviate hunger around the world. Abortion providers in South Carolina have filed a lawsuit seeking to block Senate Bill 1, the state's ban on abortion after just 6 weeks of pregnancy, when many people are not yet aware that they're pregnant. The challenge comes less than a month after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending the federal constitutional right to abortion. In a statement, Planned Parenthood called the law a direct assault on health care and fundamental human rights, adding, quote, without court intervention, South Carolinians will continue to suffer in a state with dangerously high rates of maternal mortality and infant mortality, particularly among Black women and babies. A warning to our audience, this next story contains graphic descriptions of sexual violence. In Ohio, police have arrested a man accused of raping and impregnating a 10-year-old girl. 27-year-old Gerson Fuentes was arraigned in Columbus Wednesday and is being held on $2 million bond. Prosecutors say he confessed to raping the girl on at least two occasions. A police detective testified the 10-year-old survivor underwent a medical abortion in Indianapolis June 30th. Her family was forced to travel to the neighboring state because Ohio state law bans abortions just 6 weeks into pregnancy with no exceptions for rape or incest. This case drew international attention after it was first reported by the Indianapolis Star July 1st and was cited by President Biden as evidence of the cruelty of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe. Many Republicans, including Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, questioned the validity of the story. Ohio Congressmember Jim Jordan tweeted, another lie, on anyone surprised? Jordan's tweet was later deleted without explanation. On Monday, Ohio's Republican Attorney General Dave Yost went on Fox News to voice doubts, telling host Jesse Waters his office hadn't heard a whisper anywhere about the case.
The rape of a 10-year-old means life in prison. I know our prosecutors and cops in this state. There's not one of them that wouldn't be turning over every rock in their jurisdiction if they had the slightest hint that this had occurred there.
On Wednesday, Yost refused to apologize for questioning the girl's story on national television. The Justice Department's asked the House committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol to turn over evidence it's collected about plans by Trump and his allies to put forward false slates of pro-Trump electors in battleground states won by Joe Biden in the 2020 election. This comes as a growing number of Democratic lawmakers are calling on Attorney General Merrick Garland to bring criminal charges against Trump based on the committee's findings. Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal tweeted, quote, "All of it points to the urgent need for DOJ to prosecute Donald Trump. If he's not held accountable, there will be enormous consequences to our democracy," unquote. Meanwhile, a 48-year-old has been arrested in Seattle on suspicion of hate crime after he allegedly threatened to kill Congressmember Jayapal. Officers found the man outside Jayapal's home Saturday night with a 40-caliber handgun holstered on his waist. A neighbor reportedly overheard the man yell, quote, "Go back to India, I'm going to kill you," unquote. Jayapal is the first Indian-American woman to serve in the House of Representatives. And in Washington, D.C., parents of children murdered in Uvalde and survivors of the Highland Park mass shooting gathered at the U.S. Capitol Wednesday to demand a federal assault weapons ban. This is Kimberly Rubio, whose daughter, Lexi, was one of 19 fourth graders and their two teachers killed by an 18-year-old gunman with an assault rifle at Robb Elementary School in May.
But there is one question that should be on the forefront of their minds. What if the gunman never had access to an assault weapon? I want that question to be the first thing to cross their mind in the morning and the last thought they have before they go to bed each night. Because we are no longer asking for change. We are demanding it, and we are angry as hell.
And a clarification on a previous headline, President Biden will become the first U.S. president to fly directly from Israel to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, not the first U.S. president to visit Jeddah. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Dear young people,
don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump. That was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah. I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem. I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years.
I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure you don't like it. So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do.
Midterms, primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there. But you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. And if you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, here's a question for you. How many shareholders meetings have you been to? Probably none, because most of us aren't really knowingly shareholders. If we're lucky enough to have some kind of pension we're paying into, we are shareholders, but we probably don't know much about what we're invested in. And while you might read all about high-frequency trading and crazily fickle shareholders who only hold a share for a matter of seconds, pension funds, churches and unions tend to be a bit different. and they can wield quite a lot of clout, even for an Amazon or a Google, because if they decide to offload their shares, it can be a big deal. So anyway, shareholders' meetings used to be pretty staid and boring affairs, but as inequality has boomed along with corporate profits, corporate AGMs are increasingly becoming sites of protest. This is Shell's recent AGM.
Stop kidding yourselves that you are doing no harm.
Shell must fall.
We will come back again and again and again.
That was an interesting start to our annual general meeting. And we have... Please, you are disrupting the order of the meeting, and I think you now need to leave.
These protesters disrupted Shell's AGM for 40 minutes, demonstrating against mega profits from unbridled state-subsidised environmental destruction. Companies like Shell have seen those kind of protests before, but you never particularly think of things like dreary old pension funds as fighting to reform the broken corporate tax system, do you? But they're turning out to be a thorn in the side of big companies at their carefully managed AGMs. They might not be as noisy as those protesters, but these big companies want their AGMs to be shiny, seamless, polite, choruses of agreement. And the mainstream media might not be reporting on the clash of values that's going on at these AGMs, but a change in the consciousness of the investors is happening, and it's been happening for a while. And the Amazons of this world don't like it one bit.
So Amazon has taken advantage of the pandemic to move all of their AGM online. It is a wholly virtual AGM, and despite a lot of the rest of society opening up, they have decided to keep the AGM entirely online rather than moving to an in-person or even hybrid approach to the AGM.
This is Katie Hepworth of the organisation Pensions and Investment Research Consultants, or PIRC. It was founded by local government pension funds in the UK, and it supports institutional investors with responsible investment. It's interesting, Katie, that Amazon has responded to the pandemic to take such good care of their shareholders when they certainly didn't do that for their workers.
Yeah, and look, throughout the process, they have just shown that they are afraid of oversight all the way to the way in which they presented the vote at the AGM.
Right, because at their recent AGM, there was a proposal from shareholders to vote for much better tax transparency at Amazon.
Yeah, they elected not to publish the vote during the AGM proper, and instead investors had to wait until, 4:59 p.m. the day before the Memorial, the Friday before the Memorial Day long weekend. So this is a company that does not want to give its own investors the oversight of its operations.
Yeah, but investors, pension funds, they need to know a fair bit of information about what a company is actually up to in order to invest. I mean, they want to know increasingly whether the company is exploiting workers, polluting rivers, poisoning the planet. And now, after years of tax justice campaigning, raising the issues of tax fairness, investors want to know whether the company is paying their fair share and if they're being secretive about the taxes, because doing the wrong thing on tax can damage the reputation of a company. And as we've discovered this month, it can cost the company retrospectively. In France, a judge recently approved a settlement that forces McDonald's to pay 1.2 billion euros in fines, penalties and back taxes. It's France's biggest ever corporate tax dodging settlement. And when the European Union started investigating them, McDonald's moved their tax base to London, where they're also paying not very much in taxes. Now the campaigners' war on ones are calling on the UK tax authorities to investigate. Amazon's also settled various tax claims, a €200 million tax claim in 2018 in France and in 2017, 100 million euros to settle a tax dispute in Italy. Wouldn't it just be easier to pay the damn tax? But as you'll see, many big companies will do what they can to wriggle out of doing the right thing, won't they? Let's get back to Katie Hepworth of PIRC.
Can you explain the process, first of all? So as I understand it, there's a meeting every year, an AGM, where shareholders get to put forward resolutions and they get to vote on them. So does that mean that you are Amazon shareholders or maybe shareholder activists? How does that work?
We've worked together with Amazon shareholders to file the shareholder proposal. Shareholders need to hold Amazon stocks for at least a year before they can file a shareholder proposal, and they need to have held a minimum of $25,000 in order to file. And at that point, they're then allowed to kind of put a proposal to the board of the company and have other shareholders vote on that.
I see. So tell me about the proposal that was put forward by the shareholders that you worked on then to vote on. What was it asking for?
Yeah, so we filed this proposal with two shareholders, the Missionary Oblates, which is a US-based religious fund, and Greater Manchester Pension Fund, one of the largest UK pension funds at the moment. And what we were asking for is that the board produce a tax transparency report in line with the GRI tax standard. Now, for those that haven't heard about the tax standard and what it entails, the GRI is asking for companies to report against four separate indicators. The first is that they provide a governance report. So they talk about who in the company is responsible for tax planning, who is responsible for overseeing tax risk. It also asks companies to talk about their engagement with other stakeholders, and that includes tax authorities, but also NGOs and other civil society organisations about their tax practices. And finally, I think one of the most significant things for us is that the GRI tax standard asks that companies produce public country-by-country reporting of their financial and tax information. And so what it does is it asks companies to disaggregate this information by every single country that they operate in, so that shareholders and other organisations can see where companies are paying their tax or where they're not paying their tax.
Right, right. So, I mean, it's pretty full-on tax transparency, isn't it? And so Amazon didn't like this resolution. They tried to appeal to the US regulator, the SEC, so that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, to stop this resolution being presented. They don't want to publicly reveal their tax activities, so they tried to stop it even getting debated and voted on. And they tried to say that tax matters for the company, it's an internal affair, and they said that this tax information wasn't useful or informative for shareholders, and that they already declare lots of tax information that other corporations don't, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So they use what is a small provision in the Securities and Exchange Commission's Act to try and argue that shareholders shouldn't be allowed to vote on this proposal. And that's an argument that shareholders should not be able to kind of vote or make proposals on issues that pertain to the everyday business of the board and the management of the company. There is one exception to this, where a proposal is about a significant social policy issue, there is an argument to be made that shareholders should be able to vote on this issue because it represents an unusual risk to the company that should, you know, have additional oversight. In the past, tax transparency resolutions have never passed a challenge at the SEC. This is what was historic about our resolution, and I think it reflects really the transformation of tax into a political issue globally.
Yeah, it's really interesting that this time the regulator, the SEC, decided to reject Amazon's attempt to stop that resolution and let it be heard and go ahead for a vote at the AGM, because they have previously declined all sorts of attempts at social policy related resolutions at AGMs. So it's really interesting, that shift.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. And I think it does show, and one of the things that I think was really important to getting it over the line was the general support by the investment sector. So we circulated a letter in support of the shareholder proposal to the SEC, and that was signed by investors with $3.5 trillion in assets under management. Significantly, the shareholders that signed that letter are not just the usual suspects. It's not who you would expect to be signing a tax letter. It's the churches, the unions, impact investors, ethical investors. We saw some of the largest asset owners and managers in the world sign on to this, from the Norges Bank, the Norwegian Pension Fund, other large pension funds, and including some American retail funds as well. So what it means is that this is an issue that's now transcended ethical investment, and it is seen as a core sustainability and governance issue for funds.
Here's Jason Ward of CICTAR, the Centre for International Tax Accountability and Research.
Obviously, yeah, it's a hugely significant step for the SEC to approve this and to dismiss Amazon's efforts to have it tossed out. This paves the way for us to continue to file this resolution at Amazon again next year and get an even higher vote, and to continue to take this to other U.S. multinational tax dodging entities as well. It's a really strong show of support for a first ever resolution of its kind. And I think it's an indication to that investors take this matter pretty seriously. I think in the past, people thought that investors' only point of view was maximizing returns to shareholders. And I think this shows that that's significantly shifted, that there are serious involved to shareholders about aggressive tax strategies, and that rules are changing dramatically and in flux. Amazon, for one, has been at the focus of a lot of global attention. It's a situation where both Presidents Trump and Biden specifically named the company as a tax dodger, and, you know, along with dozens of other world leaders, kind of pointing to Amazon as a specific example of an incredible tax dodger. So hugely significant. I think also the other thing that is not a tax perspective, but what the GRI and public country by country reporting does, is investors are completely in the dark in terms of information about any U.S. multinational, because essentially you can find out how much tax they paid in the U.S., but the rest of the world is a lump sum figure and is completely useless. And that's not just true for taxes. It's true for revenues, for profits, and for, you know, payroll figures, lots of different basic financial information that investors have no clue about without this type of reporting. So we're obviously driving this because we care about them paying a fair share and paying taxes, but there's lots of other reasons why investors need this level of transparency to make informed decisions about which companies they want to own and whether or not Amazon's business strategy or any other company's business strategy is appropriate. Not just ethical, but, you know, where are they losing money? Where are they making money? Nobody knows, because it's not reported.
Yeah, I mean, it seems the height of arrogance, really, to actually face off against your own investors and say, no, no, you don't need to know this information. We have it. We know it, but you don't need to know it. When you actually think about what they're doing, that is really pretty outrageous. If I was an investor or a shareholder in Amazon, I'd be pretty annoyed.
Yeah, the company already has this information and it already makes this information available to the tax authorities. So really all we're asking them to do is to make it public. There is no additional work for them in making this information public. We are seeing a lot of companies already start to report this information. So we have leading companies that have voluntarily adopted the standard. Companies like Shell, companies like Randstad, a labor hire provider, Ørsted. None of them have actually suffered commercially from providing this additional oversight of their operations. And, you know, really it is allowed for a greater engagement and a discussion of what they're doing.
Right. How was the AGM itself? How was that?
So each filer got 2 minutes to present their proposal as a pre-record, and each of the proposals were put up one after the other. Technically, according to the agenda, there was a space for questions at the end of those proposals. However, Amazon did not take questions and instead directed shareholders to their notice of meeting rather than taking questions on the proposals themselves. So again, this is just showing that Amazon is not making itself available to shareholders. It is not willing to meet with shareholders, and it is just kind of repeating a practice that is done for years on the issue of tax and also workers' rights issues.
Right. Let's hear that actual proposal which was made at the online Amazon AGM.
My fellow shareholders, members of the board and Mr. Chairman, my name is Father Seamus Finn, and I'm here this morning to represent the Missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate and the UIP Trust, with the Greater Manchester Pension Fund, have presented resolution number 12 with the support of investors with $3.5 trillion in assets. In the 21st century, the issues of transparency, accountability, and accuracy in regular reporting by public corporations has attracted new levels of scrutiny by those who rely on this information as they decide what companies to include in their portfolio. The stability and security of the global financial system is dependent on the legal standards and rules that have been established in numerous jurisdictions and adopted by organizations all over the world. As the world continues to face serious challenges, such as pandemics and social and environmental catastrophes, confidence in many long-standing institutions that we have relied on, including those that operate in the financial sector, is at its lowest in generations. Marshalling the commitments and the resources to respond to these challenges is everyone's responsibility, including public corporations like our company, Amazon. The resolution that we have presented is grounded on legal, moral, and ethical foundations that were designed to promote and protect the common good, serve to foster prosperity, and support the well-ordered functioning of societies for centuries. Responsible and sustainable corporations should want to have a reputation for doing their fair share to make such a vision a reality. Instead, Amazon has been named as one of the handful of companies who have worked to stymie efforts to reform the global tax regulatory system. Tax avoidance negatively impacts communities and increases risks to investors. Issuing the kind of report that our resolution is requesting will be a good way to demonstrate the resolve of our company to join with other leading companies and work with investors to deliver a global economy that works for all. Thank you.
There you go. It doesn't sound like something to get so very upset over or try to stop even being heard. But then we're reasonable people who think that companies should behave decently when it comes to tax and a whole load of other things. I'm going to ask you about the result of the shareholders' vote on this. But before that, just for some context and comparison, back in 2014, I reported on the TaxCast on Google's annual shareholder meeting and a proposal that was made back then on ethical tax principles. I'll play you a bit from the proposal itself and then the reaction from one of the shareholders to that proposal, which is quite interesting. Let's just have a listen.
We think tax avoidance threatens future innovation and growth and more. Ultimately, corporate tax avoidance is a threat to government and to the rule of law, and no investor or company can really succeed for very long without a functioning government and legal system. As fiduciaries and long-term investors, we need resilient economies and societies that can stand up to the inevitable shocks that the future will bring. So we think Google's board should ask itself, what is the end game here? How long can our company and our economies survive if corporations continue a race to the bottom on tax? So today, your shareholders are asking you to set a higher standard. Thank you.
The proposal to pay more taxes is outrageous. Why did you let that go through? What a stupid idea. Why doesn't Google fight at the SEC to throw these crappy proposals out?
He's not happy, is he? And just note that he's asking there why Google didn't try to get the SEC to stop that proposal even being heard, as Amazon just tried to do and failed. Let's hear the details of how that vote back in 2014 went from Adam Kanzer of Domini Social Investments, who was involved, who I spoke to at the time.
Well, this is possibly the lowest vote I've ever received on a shareholder proposal. First off, it's important to understand the structure of the voting at Google. So the three top executives hold an additional class of shares that grants them 10 votes for every share. So normal shareholders get one vote per share. They get 10 votes per share. So they control more than 60% of the vote. And in some cases, depending on, you know, how many shareholders actually vote, it could be upwards of 70% of the vote. So I didn't expect to get a very high vote. And I know this is a new issue for a lot of investors. And I think also, you know, a lot of investors have this knee-jerk reaction when you raise the question of corporate tax. The assumption is that tax minimization is in shareholders' best interests. And why would I encourage a company to pay more in tax? That being said, the vote was even lower than I expected. So we got a 1% vote. If you take out the management control shares, it only rises to 4%. Still extremely low, but a very high percentage of abstention. So close to 20% of shareholders abstained, which to me means that there's a lot of large institutional investors out there that are on the fence about this issue, that don't have a policy, and did not want to go so far as to vote with management or to vote against. You know, they really couldn't quite work it out yet. So I'm not that surprised that the vote was very low, and I'm heartened by the fact that there were so many investors that chose to abstain.
Okay, so that was 2014. So, Katie, what was the result of the vote at Amazon's AGM in 2022? I mean, once Amazon did actually release that information to the shareholders.
So, look, we got a huge vote at the AGM. So, one in five independent shareholders voted for the tax transparency proposal, which is a huge number for a first-time proposal.
So, the final vote tally was 17.5%. But bear in mind, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos and other directors collectively own 13% of the company, and they'll always vote with the management, right? So if you take their shareholdings out of the picture, it's a better reflection of what the independent shareholders are really thinking about tax. And that vote tally is 21%.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that 20% of the vote, or one in five shareholders, is usually enough to get companies to start taking an issue seriously. And you would expect at that point that companies would actually start to look at an issue, start to meet with shareholders to understand what the issue is that shareholders are raising with the board and what steps the company can take to address the concerns of shareholders. Shareholder proposals are not binding in this sense. So what it is about doing is influencing the company. And we often see companies start to move at that point.
So a better result than you'd expected. Amazon and many companies need more pushing. So how else can we push them to do what we want on tax justice? Jason, let's talk a bit about procurement.
Yeah, so Amazon is government contracting business is growing incredibly fast, particularly in the last couple of years, and driven in part by the pandemic, which accelerated the process, right? Every government everywhere around the world is moving to cloud-based platforms, and Amazon Web Services is the number one global provider of those services. So everybody knows that Amazon as being the retail company, and you can get your package shipped to you super quickly. But really, that business is a very low margin business. They don't make a lot of money on that. It's a huge business. It's a growing business. But historically, there's not a large profit margin in there. On the cloud computing side, they make tons of money. It's highly, highly, highly profitable. And it's the public sector in large part that is driving that profit and those margins. So absolutely, it's a form of madness to be kind of giving large government contracts to multinationals that don't pay their taxes. It seems that that's a very common sense provision that all governments at every level should be looking at, you know, and so there are probably alternative companies that you could use. But if you're going to go with an Amazon, why not make it a condition of their contract that they publish country by country reporting as a simple condition? It's not excluding them from getting the contract. It's saying, we'll give you this contract, but under these conditions. This type of business is happening at every level of government. So, for example, in the United States, you know, you have school boards, school districts that are contracting with Amazon, local cities, counties, states. And this is true globally. There's no reason why at any level they can't make that same requirement. And if a company like Amazon doesn't want to abide by that, then thankfully there are competitors who can provide those services.
Right. it's a really difficult one, that. I know there's been work ongoing for years to try to bring in those type of conditions on bidding for public contracts. But is it over-optimistic in your view for me to say that tax transparency feels inevitable? You know, corporations could be dragged kicking and screaming, or they can just see the way the water's flowing and jump in. Am I being over-optimistic in your view?
No, I don't think you're being. I think that we will see people taking the lead. And we do have examples of that already, right? A company like Vodafone, who's still dodging its taxes, but has championed transparency. And Randstad, which is the world's largest temporary worker, labor hire, multinational, they do public country-by-country reporting, and it shows you that they're shifting their profits to places like Luxembourg and Singapore, and Vodafone not that different. But hey, it's a very positive step for them to be kind of transparent about what they're doing, and it's up to others to decide what consequences, for governments to decide whether that's the company that they should be contracting it, or with consumers to decide whether that's behavior that they want to support. But right now, governments don't have that information available to them unless the company makes it public, because they can't make a procurement decision based on information that the tax office is required by law to keep secret. So the only way we can inform contracting and public opinion is to make that information public, because one part of the government can't share it with the other, because it's illegal for them to do that at this point in time. We've just had an election in Australia, and under the new government, they have committed to public country-by-country reporting for all multinationals, and there are specific provisions that they sort of took to the election around contracting as well. So we're optimistic of getting some reform here, and obviously the European Union did push forward a very weak form of country-by-country reporting, which is just European member states and is problematic blacklist of tax haven countries. But nonetheless, there is a growing global trend to require mandatory tax transparency proposals. And just to add to that as well, I think that this effort is really helping to shift the dialogue in the United States in particular as well, around the SEC rulemaking process and the Financial Accounting Standards Board, who are actively looking at requirements for country-by-country reporting, not on a voluntary basis, but mandatory. And we have, you know, legislation that has passed the U.S. House of Representatives in support of full public country-by-country reporting. And so the fact that some of the world's largest investors are now out there in favor of it helps to push those conversations further along as well.
Right, and also there is this question about reputation. I mean, I probably wouldn't be going around, if I was a shareholder of anything, which I'm not, but if I was, I probably wouldn't be going around telling people, hey, I'm a shareholder with Amazon, because there is massive kind of reputational risk and the kind of increasing shame attached to connection with a company that is not being transparent, not treating its workers well, and just pretty much riding roughshod over all sorts of principles that we think increasingly our societies are important to us.
Yeah, on that point, part of our engagement, what we found was a number of tax-aware investors and a number of the investors that have really led the push globally, not just on tax disclosure, but also on tax avoidance as an investment issue, and the importance of fair taxation and responsible taxation. did not hold Amazon. So they'd already divested from Amazon on the basis of their labor practices, on the basis of their tax practices, and on their human rights practices. And so we do see that there is a reputational risk associated with these companies, and that really to bring about change and to bring about greater legitimacy and restore faith, not just in these companies, but the overall tax system, we really need this kind of reporting. I just want to go back a step as well to your original question around, is this kind of reporting inevitable? And I think it is. I think where we're at with tax reporting is where climate reporting was 10 years ago. And if we look at the history of climate reporting, then we can see the importance of actually starting to target individual companies over tax disclosure and the way shareholder proposals at individual companies about their climate disclosure snowballed into regulatory reform for mandatory disclosure. I think what we're seeing now is that different countries are exploring mandatory disclosure, but they're often faced with a lot of lobbying by the same corporations that want to keep their reporting secret. And if we can take away the legitimacy of this kind of lobbying and of a failure to disclose on tax, then we might be able to see some of that mandatory legislation being rolled out in multiple jurisdictions and see cross-sector transformation.
I think Amazon is also, I mean, it's just a perfect example of how the global tax system is utterly broken and in need of a massive overhaul, right? This is a company that was taken to court by the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, the tax authority in the United States, and by the European Union. And in both cases, the case of them avoiding taxes via subsidiaries in Luxembourg was absolutely clear. But the courts ruled in favor of the company, and under existing laws, the courts determined that that behavior was legitimate. And I think, you know, any bystander looking at this should come to the conclusion that that should not be legal acceptable behavior. And I think, you know, that obviously transparency doesn't stop the abuse, but it is on the pathway there to changing corporate behavior.
Well, it shines a light on it, doesn't it?
Yep.
What's next?
Look, I think the vote puts other companies on notice that investors expect greater transparency. We're now exploring where else we can file a similar proposal. So obviously tech companies with their history of tax dodging and poor disclosure are really high up on the list for us. In addition to that, we are also engaging with companies across a range of sectors around their tax practices. We're looking at companies in sectors that have a reliance on public contracts, because we do believe that there is a responsibility of companies that rely on government revenue for their contracts to disclose where and how they're paying their taxes. Looking at infrastructure, utilities, and the care sector as our core sector, in addition to filing more shareholder proposals over the fall and spring season.
So watch out for more shareholder proposals coming to an AGM near you. My thanks to Katie Hepworth of Pensions and Investment Research Consultants and to Jason Ward of the Centre for International Tax Accountability and Research. Check out the show notes for some further reading on this. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back with you next month. Bye for now.